I felt like I was being especially cruel to poor Linda in the office last week. But she probably wasn't that surprised. I told her, I need your help with something that will leave you feeling very sad. And she hesitated. Did I do something wrong? She asked. No, I said. It's worse than that. Is somebody in the hospital? No. It's worse than that. I need you to remind me, I said, of that play in the fifth game of the National League playoffs that ultimately meant the Dodgers' dream season was about to end. Yeah, that's pretty mean, I know. But I was doing it for Jesus, okay? It was the ninth inning. The game was tied. The Dodgers catcher, Will Smith, came up to bat with a chance to end the series right there and send them on to the championship series. And Smith smashed the ball, and it flew out toward the outfield end, and it looked like it was going out, and the Dodgers came out of the dugout, and they climbed the fence, and they started to cheer and begin their celebrations, and the ball fell short, landing harmlessly into the glove of the Nats outfielder. Instead of ending the game with a Dodgers walk-off win, it continued into extra innings, and the Dodgers, 106 wins this season, most people expecting them to finally win it all, lost the game and the series on a grand slam by a former Dodger, and once again, it was wait until next year. I mean, it didn't matter if the ball missed the fence by less than a couple of inches, right? It missed the end. But Linda was looking a little sad, and I didn't want her to be the only one feeling bad, so I turned to Pastor Mike, who was also standing there. So, Pastor Mike, I said, remind me of that season-ending Vikings field goal. Which one, he asked. It's the Vikings. There's more than one. Are you talking about the 98 championship game when the Vikings had a perfect season going and the kicker Gary Anderson, who had not missed a field goal all season, shanked it, allowing the Falcons to come back, beat them, make them the best team never to get to a Super Bowl? Wow, I thought. He's had his heart crushed many times. Or, Pastor Mike continued, because he was on a roll now, maybe you're thinking of Blair Walsh in 2016 when he sent a game-winning 27-yard chip shot wide to the left in the final seconds, and the Seahawks went on to the next round of the playoffs, and the Vikings went home again. And I thought I saw a tear forming in his eye. See, here's the brutal truth. Doesn't matter if the hit was inches away from being a home run. It wasn't a home run. It was an out. Doesn't matter if the field goal attempt was inches to the left or inches to the right of the goalpost. You don't get any points for trying hard. If it falls short, if it misses the mark, game over. Here's your party bag. Go home. Don't come back. See you next year. That's the way it works, huh? You shouldn't expect anything else. No wiggle room. Those are the rules. That's the law of the game. The rules must be followed. You fall short, you're out. You miss the mark, you lose. And that right there is a problem for us. Because as Paul points out today in the second lesson that we heard read to us from Romans, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Here's the unfortunate, universal, unavoidable truth, Paul says. Every hit you get in life falls short. Every kick you make bends to the left or to the right. Every single one, every single time. And it's no one's fault but your own. Miss the mark, game over. Those are the rules. But, we stutter. Oh, that's a little harsh, don't you think? See, we have this tendency to look around us and say, the bad is out there. If only we could root out the bad that's out there, things would be better. I mean, it's the terrorists, it's the racists, it's the hate mongers, it's the Democrats, it's the Republicans. It's those cheating rich celebrities and their college entrance scandal. That's the problem. See? It's out there. And then Paul comes along this morning and he says, No. Problem's not out there. Problem's in here. Problem's in me. Problem's in you. It's what lives inside of us like a cancer, feeding off our every thought, eating away at our every impulse, bending and twisting us in on ourselves, causing us to fall short of the perfection for which God created us, and then encouraging us to move the goalposts so we can pretend that every errant kick is actually a score. You fall short, you're out. You miss the mark, you lose. Those are the rules. Paul puts it this way in verse 20 in today's lesson. No one can ever be made right in God's sight by doing what his law commands. The more we know God's law, the clearer it becomes that we are not obeying it. Trying hard, being a pretty good person, does not win you the game any more than claiming after hitting the ball into the outfielder's glove or grazing the goalpost on the wrong side, well, at least the ball was going in the right direction. In John's gospel, Jesus describes our situation even more poignantly than Paul. Jesus was speaking to the Pharisees, and they were all about denying their true reality, their true situation, not unlike us. Jesus speaks and they throw out their chests when Jesus suggests that his truth can make them free. And they huff, ha, 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 we've never been slaves to anyone. Bad case of faulty memory there, guys, because the whole history of their people has been one case of captivity after another to Egypt, to Babylon. And at the very moment they claim they're not slaves to anyone, they're slaves to Rome. I mean, it should have been obvious to them, but to pretend that something is not so does not make it not so. Jesus says it's like this. We who do wrong are in a very real way tied up by and to and with that wrong. We who sin are enslaved to sin, he says. That's what sin does. It makes you its captive. Now, there are all sorts of ways that we can become a captive to something. Drugs, sex, money, success, bad relationships, material desires, fear, anger, unforgiveness, and on the list goes. And there's all sorts of a captivity, but see, they all have the same thing in common. We're bound up by what captivates us. We're shaped by what holds on to us. Denying the truth of our situation just leaves us as captive as ever. Cut off. Isolated in that captivity. That's what sin does. Inga was a member of my congregation in the 80s. It was back during a time when AIDS hysteria gripped the nation. Everyone worried that you could get it from using a public toilet seat. Terrified that the lethal infection out there could somehow, without any one suspecting, get inside of us to do its deadly work. Well, it had gotten inside of Inga, and it made her its captive. Years before, Inga and her husband had been involved in a horrendous car crash that left him dead and her in desperate need of blood, and the paramedics rushed her to the hospital. But the blood that saved her life also condemned her to death, because that was back when blood was not screened for the virus and it contained HIV. Over time, her symptoms began to develop, progressing until she was hospitalized for what was going to be the final time at UCLA. And I went to see her a couple of days before she died, and when I walked into the room, I was by hospital procedure all wrapped up in protective latex and surgical mask and hospital scrubs, and I found Inga all alone, her hair nearly gone, her skin mottled with sores, her lips cracked open, and the inside of her mouth caked with dried blood. And she was staring into that lonesome space that marks the boundaries of this world, and the loneliness in the room hung heavy. And I pulled up a chair and I visited with her, though she was no longer able to carry on a conversation. And after a bit, I fell into silence and I simply sat there beside her bed. And I prayed for her, and then it was time to go. And I was about to make the sign of the cross on her forehead, certain that it was the last time I or anyone besides hospital staff would see her, and I wanted to leave her with that mark that reminded her of her baptism. And as I did, I glanced down at my latexed hand, and I remember feeling the deepest sadness. I thought about how in those final moments, when she most needed human contact, the disease that ravaged her body had also cut her off from the warmth of human touch. So despite hospital procedures, and not without a little bit of apprehension on my part, I tugged at my mask and I pulled off my gloves, and reaching out, I pressed my hand against her cheek and I stroked her wispy hair, and placing my fingers to her forehead between lesions that looked like giant blotches of disease, I made the sign of the cross and I whispered to her of God's dependable love and the certainty of his resurrection promise, and therefore the certainty of hers. Now, on my way home, I caught myself glancing down at my hands, thinking about what I had just done, and wondering if maybe the virus that infected her might have swarmed across her skin and found some microscopic crack, some barely discernible flaw in my own skin through which it would infect me. I was scheduled to be out of town after that, so it was a day or two later. I was spending long hours behind the steering wheel driving back to Minnesota. And her face would swim up from somewhere deep in my thoughts, and I would see her again. And it turned out that while I was somewhere amid the cornfields of Iowa, she died. My colleague led her funeral. But I touched her. And it felt like perhaps the most holy moment I would ever participate in. And that is what sin is like. It's like this disease that cuts us off from hope, that's gotten inside of us and begun to rot our soul. Now, that does not mean we are terrible, horrible, no good, very bad people, worms of no worth. It simply describes our reality. It simply explains our condition, broken, isolated from God and from each other, always having to accommodate the secret guilt we carry. Maybe happy with who we are, but also regretting those many, many times when we were less than we had hoped, and feeling horrified about what we did or did not do, what we said or did not say, what we thought or did not think, always coming up short of who we know we were meant to be, forever struggling to be free, yet knowing that at some deep, fundamental place, we remain captives, bearing a weight of deep sadness because we know this sin infection is in us and at the end of the day will leave us dying. Because sin owns us, and we do our best to deny it, but we never can. And that's what preoccupied Martin Luther. See, he knew who he was. He was appalled by his own sin. He was haunted by his own conscience, acutely aware of the infection within him, the captivity to sin he endured, and how totally he fell short of what God required. And he described it this way in his own words: "Before God, I was a sinner with an extremely troubled conscience. I could not be sure that God was appeased by my satisfaction. I did not love, no, rather, I hated the just God who punishes sinners." And on top of Luther's own personal struggles with his conscience, what gave rise to the Reformation was the church's teaching that sent people scurrying off to secure their salvation through accumulating enough points through good works to offset their sin, which was an impossible proposition from the get-go. It went something like this. Yes, Christ died for you, but no, that was not enough. There had to be something more. And that more constituted your part of the deal, your contribution, your own efforts to impress God with your goodness. It was like Jesus had pitched a softball to you, but you still were responsible for hitting it over the fence all on your own. It was like he was holding the football for you, but you still had to push it through the goalposts yourself. And that, Luther said, was a poisonous notion. At odds with the very teaching of the Bible, and it turned good news into bad news. And Luther realized that when he studied this passage from Romans that we read this morning, and the words of Jesus from the gospel, that the righteousness of God is his gift to us, not his measuring stick of us. Because we are justified in grace by Christ's work on the cross. We are set free by Jesus himself. And that freedom comes from him with no strings attached. That freedom is complete and total and unqualified. Not because it cleans us up a little bit, but because it makes us new. Not because it puts a Band-Aid on a paper cut, but because it cures us of this infection. It takes us dead in sin, and it makes us alive in Christ. Grace is the pardon we hear from the judge when we are guilty and have no excuses. Grace is the mercy before you've paid the price. Grace is not the settling of accounts. It is the total canceling of the debt. It is the utter surprise that something and someone outside of us, something we didn't achieve on our own, is going to be the thing that saves us. If sin is the diagnosis of the disease that's going to take your life, grace is the cure that enables you to live. And this is what Jesus does. Jesus touches the sin that most repulses us. He makes contact with the very thing that causes us the deepest pain and the most profound shame. He handles our leprous interior lives, and as a result, he catches what we have. For our sake, he becomes infected with our sinfulness. In Christ, God comes to us, and he shares our condition, and he pays dearly for it. He who was without sin took on our sin and took it away to the cross, that he might set us free from its plague and we might live by faith as his. And that is why we remember the Reformation this morning. And that's why we tell this basic story of our captivity and our freedom again and again and again and again. Even if we've heard it or preached it 1,000 times, we tell it again. Because it's the only thing that truly matters. And so you can never hear it and you can never speak it too many times. It never gets old, because good news never gets old. Luther and the Reformation sent us back to the Bible, where we learn that if the Son has set you free, you will be free indeed. And for even though all have sinned and fall short, all are set right with God freely by his grace that comes through Jesus and his sacrifice for us. How can that ever get old, right? That would be like saying ice cream gets old, or pie gets old, or cookies get old. The bad news of dieting always gets old, but the good news of warm, fresh chocolate chip cookies right out of the oven, baked by Barbie, never gets old. Nor does the sweet good news of the gospel of grace. So come to the table this morning. Taste it for yourselves.